Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everybody, I'm Zale Mednick and welcome to another episode of Preconceived. This episode is a follow-up episode, the second episode to the one we did last week called Sick Boy with Jeremy Saunders. If you didn't listen to that episode, I recommend you listen to it first. If not, you'll still be able to catch up with this episode regardless. And with no further ado, here is the episode of Preconceived.
You are listening to Preconceived, where we examine the preconceptions that shape how we view the world and the paradigms by which we live our lives.
Hey everybody, I'm Zale Mednick and welcome to another episode of Preconceived. What if you knew from the beginning of your life that you would die at age 30? How would you choose to live those 30 years? Needless to say, your path would completely deviate from many elements of the preconceived status quo of a typical life. And what if, just as you were reaching the end of your predicted life expectancy, you found out that you would not indeed die at age 30, but that you would have a normal life expectancy? Would you be happy for the extra years? Or would you be rattled by such an upheaval in your expectations? I'm joined today by Jeremy Saunders. Jeremy is an award-winning actor, producer, and host of popular original Canadian media, including film, television, and podcasts. He's the founder of Snack Labs, an audio production company focusing on audio documentaries and podcasts in the health and life sciences sector. In the culmination of his affinity for laughter and education, he co-created CBC's Sick Boy podcast alongside his two best friends, with the hopes to fundamentally change the way we navigate communicating about health, illness, and death. Jeremy has cystic fibrosis and was originally given 30 years to live. He is now 36. All right, Jeremy Saunders, welcome back to the podcast, part two.
I'm so happy to be back. I like to be fully honest with you, Zale. Like, I loved that conversation the last time we sat down. And I'm a fan of the show. So it's just such a pleasure to be able to spend more time with you.
Well, thank you. The feeling is absolutely mutual. I think I got more out of it than you did, but it was really, really so delightful talking to you. And we had already planned on doing a part two before we did part one, but I'm even more excited. Excited for it now. You're so captivating and have such an interesting story, and you're able to articulate that so well. And today we're talking about something that is, I mean, when I came to you asking if you'd join the podcast, we talked about let's talk about Sick Boy and this idea of how do you deal with people who are labeled as sick. Yeah. And you said, let's do that. But I've also had this really weird experience in my life where I was given 30 years to live, essentially. You found out at age 10, you were diagnosed at age one that you had cystic fibrosis. At age 10, you found out through a school pamphlet, essentially, that your life expectancy was 30. Mm-hmm. And then you found out later on in your life, and you're now 36, spoiler, like I said, but you found out that there was a new medication that would increase your life expectancy. Yeah. And you described it to me in an email as a mind fuck. And that must be an understatement of the year, because I cannot imagine that circumstance. And I want to walk through what it's been like for you, starting from the beginning, the first portion of your life, thinking you would only have 30 years. And then we'll pivot to how things changed, how you felt, which there might be preconceptions about. But tell me, you're 10 years old, you find out in this bizarre way in a school pamphlet, basically saying there's a kid in your class who has cystic fibrosis, it's a lethal condition. How does your life shift when you know in your mind you've only got 20 years to live? When I conceived of this podcast initially, my thought was preconceived is really about the way you live your life. There is kind of the specific path that we all take. You're born, many of us are born into a nuclear family. You have a typical childhood. You have a typical education. You have coming of age experiences, whether you go to camp, whether you go traveling, go to college or have a job, dating, settle in a career, typically a monogamous marriage, have kids, maybe have grandkids, retire, die, and tackling each one of those elements. For you, that whole thing gets condensed. And I have to imagine you said, well, that status quo blueprint on how to live life has to go out the window because I'm not living the same life of other people. So that's a very verbose way of asking you, what was your mindset thinking you've only got 20 more years to live?
Yeah, it's such a huge question because it's definitely not a simple answer where, you know, I find out by reading that pamphlet when I'm 10, oh, I'm going to die at 30. And then, you know, the next day, all of a sudden I'm living with this idea in the back of my head and going, all right, everything I do from now on is going to be focused on that one notion that like I've got this looming cloud and my time is up, my time is nigh. So I guess the first thing I'll say, because I'm sure that there's at least somebody out there with the question of like, wait a minute, you found out through a pamphlet. Why the fuck didn't your parents tell you? Like what was going on there? My parents, I was born in Newfoundland, St. John's, Newfoundland. My whole family's from Newfoundland. And when we found out that I had cystic fibrosis, my parents uprooted their life and they moved to Halifax, Nova Scotia, which is where I'm actually based now. And they did that because the IWK, which is the Children's Hospital here in Halifax, had and still has one of the best cystic fibrosis clinics in the country for pediatrics. And so when they moved here and started to raise their family here, they had my sister, you know, when I was 2, she was not born with cystic fibrosis. And as I was growing and, you know, starting to talk and starting to walk and making friends and starting to understand that I'm a conscious being, my parents had this question in the back of their mind, like, okay, when the fuck do we tell him that CF is fatal? And so they would continuously ask the CF clinic, and their, you know, my healthcare providers would tell them, oh, you don't tell Jeremy. What will happen is Jeremy will find out on his own. And when he does, he'll come to you and he'll have all these questions. And these are the questions that he'll probably ask. And here's, you know, we can talk about how you should respond, but don't be the ones to broach it. Let him come to you. So sure enough, 10 years old, I do find out on my own. They were right about that. Unfortunately, I didn't go to my parents with any questions. I took that info and I did the classic, you know, millennial male thing. I took those emotions and I buried them deep. I pushed them so far down and I didn't deal with it. I think I blocked it out. You know, the next day after reading that pamphlet, I went to school and I, you know, went on the playground and tried to kiss a girl and fell off the monkey bars. And, you know, it was just a normal fucking day, as if I didn't read this profound existential fact that my clock is ticking very fast. Now, this information wasn't like completely forgotten. It obviously was bubbling under the surface. And when I was 16, I had an English assignment where we were supposed to write an autobiography about ourselves. And It's funny, like I don't even remember writing this autobiography. I remember getting it back and being like, oh, hell yeah. Like I got a 96%. That's, you know, I was a subpar student. So like high grades were, it was always a delightful surprise. I did really well in English and you know, performative arts, terrible in math, terrible in sciences. So I was stoked that, you know, that's the only thing I remember about that process, about that assignment. I came to find out after I finished that assignment. And again, my mom and my dad, still, I'm 16, they are still going to the IWK going, when is he going to talk to us about this? Are you sure we shouldn't be saying something? And they stuck with that message. They're like, no, he'll come to you. So when I finished that assignment, my teacher, Mr. Strugnell, God rest his soul, awesome guy, he was amazing. He called my mom and he said, hey, Maxine, did you happen to read Jeremy's autobiography assignment? And my mom was like, no, I did not. Jeremy does not share anything with me. He does not communicate with me. He will not let me see anything or have anything to do with his life. And Mr. Strugnell said, well, Maxine, I hope you take what I'm about to say very seriously. You have to find that autobiography and you must read it. And so my mom, as soon as I left, I don't know, probably went to my friends again, just like hit that big old bowl of dank weed from Lower Sackville, Nova Scotia. And as I was out getting stoned, my mom went into my room. She rooted through all my shit and she found that assignment and she read it. And there was a chapter 4 that I titled My Future. And she read this section and it was, in her words, it was one of the hardest moments of her entire life. I actually have it here if you want me to read it. It's quite short, but there you go. So this is what my mom read. Part 4, my future. When it comes to thinking about my future and what I want to do with my life, when it comes to getting married and having kids, I don't really know what to think. About 40% of children with cystic fibrosis live beyond the age of 18. The average lifespan for those who live to adulthood is 30 to 33. If you think about it, what's the point of getting married if I'm only going to live a few years through the marriage? And having a kid would be pointless unless I wanted them to grow up over half their life without a dad. These kinds of things are hard to think about, and it makes me feel kind of useless. That moment was the moment that my mom realized that I had known. And not only did I know, but I had known long enough that it had affected the way that I thought about how I was going to not age. And her and my dad, I mean, their whole world kind of crumbled in. And again, they were born in a small town in Newfoundland. They were born in the 60s. You would think that after reading that, that the, you know, initial thought would be, okay, well, we have to sit Jeremy down and have a conversation, but that they didn't. They did what I did. They buried it down. They were too afraid. They pushed it away. They were confused. They didn't know how to broach this. When I think about that autobiography and I think about that section, I think that was the first time that I ever outwardly shared my thoughts on this topic. It was the first time I ever put it to paper. It was the first time that anybody outside of myself was given an opportunity to see the way that I was thinking, the way that I was feeling. And I think that putting that pen to paper and getting that thought out there, I think that moment at 16, that was the moment where, whether I was actively thinking about it or not, maybe it was more subconscious, but that was the moment where I was kind of faced with this crossroads, this decision where it's like, okay, I have two paths I can go down right now. I can choose the path of fear, where I let this fear of living a shortened life expectancy consume me and let it affect me and allow it to prevent me from leaning into what life has to offer. Or I can choose the path where I take that fear and I mold it and I shape it and I turn it into a tool. And that tool can be something that I can use to carve out the life that I want. And I think I chose that path, that moment. Fast forward went to when I was 20 years old, we finally had that conversation, my mom, my dad, and I, and my sister. It was Christmas break. I had come home from Toronto from school. We sat down for like a Christmas dinner, just the four of us. And my mom brought it up. And it was a explosive conversation, a conversation that was fueled by resentment and emotion, not a lot of logical thinking on my part. And I lashed out and I told them what I had been feeling. And as I was telling them what I was feeling, I was also telling myself and admitting to myself how I had been feeling. It didn't dawn on me until that conversation that I really resented my parents. I harbored so much anger towards my mother, especially. You know, when she responded to Mr. Strugnell and said, he doesn't tell me anything. She wasn't joking. It wasn't like your typical teen sort of, you know, it's not cool anymore to hug your mom or tell your mom you love her. It was much more than that. You know, I remember countless times in my youth when I was 15, 16, 17, where my mom would be sobbing, weeping, like keening to me on her knees, begging, please, just please tell me you love me. Please. Oh man, I'm sorry. It's really,
don't apologize.
It just,
are you emotional because you're thinking about how she felt during that moment, or just bringing back so much emotion of that whole time period and that heated conversation at Christmas?
I'm emotional because I am now older than my parents were when they had me. And I don't have a child yet. But I have a really hard time. I have a really hard time imagining how hard that must have been for her.
Yeah.
It's soul crushing. Like, to be begging your child to just show some, even a glimmer of affection, like that is just, holy smokes. It just breaks my heart that she had to go through that. And I don't blame my parents for what they didn't do or what they did. You know, it was a couple of years later, we came back to that conversation and I forgave them and I apologized to them for the way that I internalized all of that.
But not that you need any validation or vindication, because what you're saying makes total sense. You're also sitting there as a 10-year-old, having lived for 10 years with the knowledge that you're going to die in 20 years and you have nobody to talk to and nobody's reaching out for you, regardless of what the intent was, regardless of what the advice was. So it's a pretty impossible situation on both ends. I mean, the misery you must have been experiencing consciously at a certain point, I'm sure your mother would be tearing up if she was having this conversation with me about trying to sort through what you were going through.
Yeah. And you know, it's funny, like it kind of comes back to a similar point to what we were covering in that first episode, which is like, I was 10, and what I needed in that moment was for someone to come to me and say, hey, Jer, this sucks. How are you doing? How do you feel about this? But instead, they're, you know, for whatever reason, which is beyond me, the advice from the healthcare providers was like, oh, no, don't fuck him up by bringing it up yourself. You got to let him come to you. Thankfully, that is not the
parting line anymore.
Yeah, that's not the suggestion now. But at the time, unfortunately, it was. So, yeah, it was that moment at 16 where there was kind of a shift, I think. And it was that moment that made me kind of start to lean into the idea of, okay, this is outside of my control. If it's outside of my control, there's nothing I can do, but there's a whole fuckload I can do about the things that are within my control. And so I started to just take things on in life that maybe otherwise I probably wouldn't have, you know, from things as basic as going, I'm going to go to university to study acting. And that's, I know that that's a financially a bad choice, but who fucking cares? That brings me joy. And financial, like, what the fuck do I have to worry about finances? I'm not going to retire, you know, I'm going to die before I'm 30 probably. So I might as well just do what brings me joy, and performance brings me joy. So I'm going to go to theater school, you know?
Which is a pretty healthy mentality, no?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that, like, you know, I was the valedictorian of my high school, and that was a part of my speech, which was like, hey, don't settle for less if you're in a position where you want more. Do the things that bring you joy. Do not cloud your judgment and do the things that you think you should be doing because your parents say so or your friends are doing it. Like, do what is true to you if that's the thing that makes you feel like you are living the most full life. And I think that that's, you know, again, that's one of those things that I'm so grateful that I received from cystic fibrosis. Like, CF is the best thing that has ever happened to me, period. It totally shaped me into the person that I am. And I love who I am. I love who I've become. And I love that my illness played a part in that. Again, I want my illness to define me.
There's this Aerosmith quote, which is, I don't even know if they created it, probably not, but life's a journey, not a destination. It's really cliche. And I'm leaning into the cliche, I guess.
Yeah.
It's something that is very easy for all of us to say, and we all say that and enjoy the moment, live in the present. It's not about the outcome. But that really, really, in some ways, is easier for somebody like you to, you are forced to confront that and say, yeah, I mean, it has to be, right? Because otherwise, what is the point of me going to acting school, right? Because if my goal is to be this super successful actor, that's going to be pretty tough, but I love acting. Yeah. But I love, it's tough anyway for anybody, but I love acting, so I'm going to do it. Or relationships, you could say, well, what's the point of having a romantic relationship? But you say, well, in the present, I value love and I value romance. So I'm going to do for the sake of the moment, not for some remote goal. Naturally, though, it is going to shape, as you said, the way you approach some of those decisions. And yeah, the cystic fibrosis and that kind of longevity of only living until age 30, in your mind, did certain choices come up that stand out to you as choices, decision points that you had to make where you said, logically, yeah, I'm going to go with this choice because it just doesn't make sense. For example, the kid thing, that's a really easy example in some ways because you're thinking about multiple people. Do you want to have a kid that you're only going to be around for 5-10 years, and the kid's going to then bear the consequences of that? And maybe that's not a fair question. Maybe it's not fair. And some people are listening to this and saying, why shouldn't I be able to have a kid if I'm only going to be able to enjoy them for 5 years? It's my life. But are there certain decision points like that that you remember where it wasn't just philosophical, but it was practically, you said, I am going to pivot here, or I'm going to take the decision in a little bit of a different way than somebody who's expecting to live till 80 would?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Like the kid one, that's a perfect example. I mean, that's one where, again, another one of those sort of fascinating aspects of cystic fibrosis is that 98% of males born with CF are born without a vas deferens. So the vas deferens was not formed in utero. So I went into a clinic in Toronto when I was like 20 and jizzed into a cup and gave them my sperm, and they called me, you know, a week or two later and like, "You are sterile." And I was like, sick. That is awesome. Oh my God. That's so cool. So there was that piece. Now that's not to say that I can't have children. I could do IVF. That is an option. But with that kind of box checked, it was like, okay, cool. I don't have to worry about accidentally having a child. And that's good because I don't ever want to do that. That is a logical decision on my part where it just does not make sense to me to bring a child into this world when I'm not going to be there to provide them a life as a father. You know, when I was 21, I met a gal from PEI, and I was smitten and thought she was cool. And like a year and a half into dating, I thought, well, I'm 21, I've got 9 years. I love this person, so fuck it. I'm just going to ask them to marry me. It's a short-term contract, you know, low stakes for them. They don't have to commit for long, and why not? So I asked her to marry me, and she said yes, and I got married at 23. If I didn't have CF, I can tell you right now, I don't think I would have done that. I think I would have taken more time to put myself out there and experience other things and other people, but my clock was ticking, and I valued love, and I thought, okay, I'm in love. There's no point in like going out searching for love elsewhere if it's here right now. And so if this person says yes, then cool, let's do that. We recently got divorced, yet we're still best friends. And so like, you know, I don't think that situation could have worked out any more perfectly.
That's a perfect example.
I was jokingly going to say we got divorced because I lived too long, and she was like, "This is not what I signed up for." But that's not the case. But you know, those types of decisions were, there was only a few of those. There were way more decisions where I said that, you know what, I don't have much time left, so I'm going to do this thing, and in any other circumstance, this is definitely not the responsible thing to do. Like in my third year of university, I got cast to host a children's television show that aired on CBC. It was called Artzuka. And we did two seasons, and it blew up. It was a huge show, and it was the remake of Art Attack. And so it was on CBC, and it aired in like 50 countries across the world. And so I did the first season in my summer of second year of university, went to my third year, did the second season, and then found out that the third season was being delayed. And they were delaying it possibly to fall within my fourth year of university. And so what I did was I said, okay, well, I made a bunch of money off this kid show. I was the only person on the show. I cashed my like first check from the show. It was like a $50,000 check. I remember walking into the bank, gave it to the teller. And, you know, at 21 years old, $50,000 check is fucking, it's nuts. So I went to the teller, and the teller was like, "Oh my God, hold on. I gotta get my manager." It was like, she had to call the pit boss in. And so I had so much money, also didn't know what to do with it. Like, didn't realize that as an independent contractor, a lot of that money's not mine, it's the government's, and didn't know that, didn't save that, spent that, which came down the line to bite me pretty hard in the future. But so I was like, I'm going to defer my fourth year because season three is coming up and I've got this like big sum of money. So I'm going to look into some things that I could do to like just have a fun experience. And my good friend and roommate in Toronto, John, he was this really amazing guy from New Brunswick, and he was an adventure guide, and he did this 3-month whitewater kayak training, whitewater raft guide, whitewater kayak guide training. Over the 3 months he did this, and then when he came out of it, he was like, all right, I'm a certified whitewater kayak guide, I'm a certified whitewater raft guide. And that's what he did for the summers to make money. And he told me about this experience that he had the year before. And I was like, fuck, that sounds so cool. What a wild experience. And I said, I don't want to be a raft guide or a kayak guide, but I want to live in a bus with 19 strangers, and I want to kayak and raft down 21 rivers between Canada, the US, and Mexico over 3 months, living out of a tent, driving that entire distance in a school bus full of supplies and towing a trailer of rafts and kayaks. So I took out a $30,000 loan, signed up, went on the trip. My parents were like, what the actual fuck are you doing? This is such a bad idea. And I did it. And it was one of the scariest, most thrilling, epic adventures I will have ever been on in my entire life. I almost died two or three times. It, you know, every day I was waking up going, this could be it. Like, you know, it was not a trip that you do for casual fun. It was high stakes. You know, I got like certified in wilderness first response training. We had to learn how to navigate class 4 rapids without a boat, just wearing a life jacket, rescuing people in the water who have fallen out of their boat. I mean, it was fucking nuts.
Jeremy, that doesn't surprise me so much that you went to that extreme.
Right.
A lot of people say, I mean, it's a philosophical question people ask themselves sometimes, or might discuss over drinks with buddies, whatever. What would you do if you only had a year to live? And most people's response probably, well, I'd fuck everything. And
yeah,
I'd go on this travel experience. I'd do something nuts, maybe even really adventurous because why not? Maybe even risky because why not?
Yeah.
And I think some people in your situation might've gone even farther off
sure. The
ledge and spent more money or just gone completely off the grid and completely detached from the status quo and regular society.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, if it wasn't for like this budding, you know, early rise to success in acting, maybe I would have been like, ah, fuck it. You know, I'm just going to go live in Uganda for who knows how long and just disappear and do whatever the fuck I want to do. But yeah, you know, there was a lot of choices like that. I mean, to the point of fucking everything, you know, my marriage, we opened up our marriage. We ended up having a polyamorous relationship that lasted for 7 years. Like, I mean, again, these are things that I probably wouldn't have dipped my toes into if it weren't for this notion that like, okay, I'm going to be dead at 30. And I can honestly say that I don't have a single regret for anything that I've ever done, but I can most certainly recognize that there are a lot of things that I have done that didn't pan out simply because now I do have a future.
Selling a little? Or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
So, Jeremy, let's do that fast forward then.
Yeah, sure.
A drug comes out several years into your 20s, Trikafta. It's approved around the time when you are expecting that your health is going to further decline and that you're going to die, basically, based on what you were told when you were age 10. What is your initial reaction to that? Tell me, I mean, that is, as I said earlier, that is nothing short of a mindfuck.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll give a little bit of context. You know, when I was 28, 29, I was doing okay. You know, my lung function was like high 60s, low 70s, which is good for someone with CF at 29 years old. I had known a lot of people with CF who had died up to this point. I had known even more who have had a double lung transplant at this point. And I was approaching my 30th birthday. And when I turned 30, it was such an epic experience. I mean, I had the wildest birthday party. We made it an event. We kind of purposely threw my birthday party on the same night that we held an event that we put together through Sick Boy called Sick Wish, where we raised over $40,000 to grant a wish to an adult who lived with a life-shortening illness. Part of that was to sort of make up for the fact that I really fucked up my children's wish. I got a wish from the Children's Wish Foundation, and you know, I could have wished for something really cool, like, I don't know, go to hang out with Adam Sandler on set for his latest movie, or, you know, he was my hero when I was growing up, or go, I don't know, like play a round of hockey with the Toronto Maple Leafs or something. I wished for a shopping spree at the Halifax Shopping Center. So,
oh, Jesus Christ.
And nobody stepped in to go, hey, Jer,
that's the biggest mistake you've made.
That, you know what, that, you know, I said I have no regrets. I do regret that. That's my regret.
That is very rough, Jeremy.
So we raised all this money, and we ended up granting the wish to a woman from here in Halifax who had leukemia, and we sent her and her daughter to Africa to go on safari. And we held this party to announce the winner. There was 500 people there. We did it in a natural history museum. Body Worlds exhibit was there at the same time, so people are going through Body Worlds looking at these cadavers that are split open, and we had people giving tattoos, and people are getting like barbers to give them haircuts, and like we just had all these activities. It was fucking epic. And that whole time I was going, look at this, I'm 30, like this is so cool. And Trikafta was not in the picture here at all, but that day, that 30th birthday, I looked at that as, okay, I've made it this far, and every year from now forward is bonus time. This is my bonus time. I didn't think I was going to get this, and so now I get to revel in the fact that I get some years that I didn't think I was going to have, and let's make them the best years that I have left. When I turn 32, Trikafta starts to make waves in the news. It gets approved in the US. There's no news about whether or not it's coming to Canada or when, but the statistics that start coming out are like jaw-dropping. And in the middle of COVID, during the pandemic, it was announced that Trikafta is going to be coming to Canada. And at this point now, my lung function is around 50%. And my hospitalizations are happening multiple times a year. My health was on a pretty like steady decline. I was having hemoptysis quite often. So that's coughing up incredible amounts of blood. And I thought, hey, this could be huge. Like if I get my hands on this, this could be huge. There was a lot of unknown answers. You know, Trikafta is a $300,000 per year drug. So like, you know, spoiler alert, if you're a self-employed actor who teaches yoga for a living and does podcasting on the side, there's not a lot of options for health insurance to pay for any medication. But living in Canada, living in Nova Scotia, I just happened to win the lottery of being in the right place at the right time. And when Trikafta came to Canada, it ended up being fully covered here in Nova Scotia. And I got my first dose in November of 2021. And so we did an episode of Sick Boy. We sat down, me, Brian, and Taylor. I brought in the box of Trikafta and I took my first dose on the episode that day. Up to this point, because of the way my lungs were, I was coughing all day, every day. I mean, if you go back to old Sick Boy episodes and listen, you hear me. I have a very distinct cough, and it's there constantly, all day, every day. 2 days after taking Trikafta, my cough disappeared. 2 months into taking Trikafta, my lung function went from 50% to 80%, the highest it had been in almost a decade. 2 months into taking Trikafta, I went from 137 pounds, which is kind of like where I hovered. You know, I'd be lucky if I got 140, which is underweight for my height and age. 2 months into taking Trikafta, I was 175 pounds. I started to become overweight. I started getting fat, which was fucking so cool. It was awesome for a minute. And then the novelty wore off really quick. So I had to make some lifestyle changes, right? Like CF patients are basically told to, you're meant to have a high fat, high calorie diet. Don't give a fuck about nutrition in terms of the value of nutrition. If slamming McDonald's is the way you get your calories, do it. Whatever you can do to maintain weight is far more important than whatever you're putting in. So I was used to doing that for 33 years. And all of a sudden, my body started reacting like a typical person's body would if you were eating, you know, 4 to 5,000 calories a day with a high fat content. So I had to shift my lifestyle. I had to shift the way that I was viewing my illness. I had to stop, not had to, but I was allowed to stop doing certain treatments that I was used to doing. You know, like every day I would sit down and do my nebulizer, this machine that takes liquid medicine, like Ventolin, turns it into vapor. And I just sit and breathe this vapor in. You know, you see kids with like a mask on in the hospital. It's one of those. I would do that twice a day, an hour a day, 2 hours. So 2 hours total a day, every single day. Had been doing this my whole life. That just got taken away. So I get 2 free hours a day that I'm not used to. It was amazing. I felt the best I had ever felt. I felt energetic. My heart rate wouldn't spike. One of the moments that like really fucking like kind of shocked me was I would take my dog for walks. And in Halifax, if you've never been here, there's an old like colonial fort called Citadel Hill. And
I have been there.
It's beautiful. It's a big hill, overlooks the harbor with cannons pointing to the harbor, but it's quite a steep hill. And I would walk Donut, my dog, up that hill. And walking up that hill was a fucking struggle. I would be so winded when I get to the top. I would have to stop. I would have to like sit down. I'd have to give my body like 4, 5, 6 minutes to like lower my heart rate. And one day I took Donut out and I was like, all right, gonna go for a walk. And I walked up to the top of the hill and I was at the top of the hill looking around like, hey, this is nice. And then I went, holy shit, whoa, wait, whoa, oh my God. I'm not even remotely winded. Wow. Wow, that's really wild. Like I noticed my cough was gone, but it was this sort of thing that I took for granted where I went, oh, wow, oh, wow. Like I have like cardiovascular ability for the first time since I was like an athlete when I was in high school. This is so cool. my mom, my, you know, my parents' friends would see me and they go, oh my God, Jeremy, you look so healthy. I still get that. I'll go out see someone I haven't seen in a couple of years and they go, holy shit, you look really healthy. And I'm like, yeah, I feel really healthy. You know, everything was like positive. Everything was good. Everything was great.
Were you happy when everything was great? When you found out that this was coming through the pipelines, Trikafta, and that this could alter the course of your life, I mean, the preconception is amazing. Was that how you felt? Or was there part of you, which some people might find it a silly question, but I don't know how I would react. This is, people don't like change. Change is very, very tough for people. Change is important and is one of the most driving factors for self-development, empowerment, that's all those buzzwords. I believe that, but change is hard. Was there a part of you that was like, I don't know if I want this. I was expecting a certain life. I was looking forward maybe to these last couple of years where I could really just live all these experiences. And aside from all the other challenges like finances that are obviously going to come into play and things you hadn't planned for, was your gut reaction, this is amazing, or was there trepidation?
I thought it was amazing. And I had a conversation with the CF clinic prior to starting Trikafta. And one of the things they said was like, hey, look, this is going to be a big shift. And if you need to speak to anybody, if you need to speak to the psychologist on duty, like we're open, we're here to talk to you about anything. And I remember hearing that going like, yeah, it's going to be a big shift, but like, it's fucking all good. So like, I don't know what, you know, like, I don't know what you guys are assuming is going to happen here, but like, this is amazing. And I had a day where I was like, yeah, this is cool. But also this feels like a bit of a weird identity shift, you know, like I'm sick boy. The whole podcast is about me living with CF. And now it's like, I still have CF, but it feels like I don't. How's this going to affect the way I identify with myself? And I don't know. I thought about it probably for like a couple of days and I went, nah, I'm good. Yeah, I'm good. This is going to be sweet. But I think we have a very sneaky ability to ignore red flags when they are right there in front of us and we just aren't willing to look. And I think that's what was happening. Last year in December, I got diagnosed with clinical depression. It came out of nowhere. I did some psilocybin, and in this trip I was having, I was like, why do I feel awful? Like, I feel awful right now. What's going on? This is so weird. And I sat down. Psychedelics have been kind of a big part of my alternative therapy for years. And I swear by them. I think they're incredible if used properly. And I was sitting there going, this is so odd. I have such a heavy, gross feeling and I don't know what the hell's going on. And so I did this thing that, you know, some people might scoff and roll their eyes at, but I was like, all right, I think the mushrooms are trying to tell you something. So just listen, listen. What are they saying? And I closed my eyes and then it dawned on me. Oh fuck. I think I'm depressed. And went in to see my doctor, my family doctor. Did a couple of like, you know, assessments. And she was like, yeah, this is like clinical depression. So here's how we can tackle it. I got set up with a therapist for like the first time ever, like my own personal therapist, not just like the therapist on call at the CF clinic. And it was through discussions with them and talking with, you know, my friends openly without shame, where I came to this realization that like, I don't think I dealt with this profound shift. And I had heard through the CF community from a lot of people that they were also in the same boat of like, I don't know how to fucking deal with this. And this depression diagnosis, this was only this past December. As of recording this right now, it's March 22nd. So like, you know, this is fresh. And I'm going to say something right now that I'm still mulling around. It's still very fresh, but I was hanging out with a new friend the other day, an acquaintance that I've known for years, but he just moved to town and we were out having beers and we were having this really beautiful, profound sort of philosophical conversation. And he said, hey, what's the deal with, weren't you supposed to die? Like when you were 30, like how are you still here? And I told him the whole situation with Trikafta. Whenever I usually tell someone about Trikafta, the response always is, holy shit, that's amazing. Period. That's it. It's done. Like that's as far as it goes. But I tell my friend Mikey this experience and I'm waiting for the typical response of, wow, that's incredible. But his response really blew my mind. He was like, holy shit, dude, is that hard? That must be hard. And I was like, yeah, I'm trying to figure it out. It feels like there might be something hard about it. And he was like, you know, it's kind of like you were the partner of somebody who's in the military and they go overseas on deployment and you get word that they were killed in action. And so you grieve the loss of that partner. And a couple of years later, you move on and you find another partner and you find new love. And you and this partner, you have kids and you have a life and you have a plan. You know what's coming. You know what the next 5-10 years are going to look like. And then all of a sudden, you get a knock at the door and you open the door. And it's that partner that you thought died. And when you open the door, he looks at you and he says, hey, I'm back. I was a POW and I fucking escaped and I never died. I'm here. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with all of a sudden this thing that you grieved, this thing that you moved on from has now re-entered itself into your life? You have a new life. You're comfortable in that new life, but now you have to face the fact that this life that you have grieved is back. And that's a fucking pickle. And that's what I'm going through right now. It's like that soldier, that past partner who died, that was the life that I grieved when I realized I'm not going to have a future. And so I processed that and I leaned into the fact that that is not my life. And I found my new life and I moved on and I leaned into that new life, that new family of you are going to die at 30. And I was so okay with it. I embraced that. But now that old life, that life with a future has come back. And I have to reconcile that. And I have to figure out, what does this mean now? How do I interact with this thing that I let go of? And that's a fucking trip, man. Like that is something that is a new lease on life is simultaneously one of the most beautiful things that one can experience, but in some circumstances, it can also be one of the most challenging things to wrap your head around.
What an incredible example. That reminds me of Castaway, actually, the movie where most powerful moment of that movie to me, I don't know if it was intended to be or not, is when Tom Hanks shows up at the end after everybody thinks he's dead and he sees Helen Hunt and says, I'm back. And she's like, I'm so happy to see you, but I've got a husband and kids inside. What am I supposed to do? And I mean, it would almost be silly for me to say, so what's the ending here? What conclusion did you come to? Because so much about our earlier part of this conversation, our last conversation, was how it is the journey, not the destination. And the journey is pretty fresh for you right now in terms of experiencing that depression, figuring out how to reconcile that. And I'm guessing that you will undergo, not to sound negative, there's going to be years of reconciling. There's going to be years of figuring out what's the answer here? What do I want now? What are some of my new goals? How do I pivot? How do I embrace this new life? One thing that's clear to me from speaking with you, though, is the way you said earlier on in our first episode that you want cystic fibrosis to you want to identify with that. There are so many amazing things that you've told me that I can already see and that are obvious to the listener. Just this idea, and I'm not saying that polyamory is for everybody, but you said when I spoke at the very beginning about there are certain steps in life, part of the status quo, and not enough of us, including myself, take time to pause and think, is this what I want? Monogamy, is that what I want? We just do that. But because you lived in a different framework, you did challenge that. And you actually had a polyamorous relationship. You did challenge, how are you going to have your career? And a lot of these questions that a lot of us spend our lives just not answering and going through the motions, you never did go through the motions. And now that you have however many years left that you have on this earth, you already have gone through the exercise that many of us spend decades not going through. And I have to imagine that will make you a better person and will make the rest of your trip around the sun. I've never used that phrase before, but use the rest of the trip around the sun more meaningful and more well spent.
Yeah. I mean, again, I'm trying to figure that out now, but you know, it's really funny. Right before I came up to the studio here to record with you, I had since the diagnosis of depression, I've started a pretty consistent daily meditation. I do like 40 minutes a day, a sort of guided meditation. The gateway process, it's based on the CIA, like men who stare at goats. But the session that I did today was about problem solving. And in the meditation, the guy that leads you through it, this guy, Monroe, Dr. Monroe, he says, think about a problem, put that problem out into the universe, and just listen. And it's going to give you the answer back. And so I was like, okay, the problem is, I'm not sure how to deal with this profound existential shift in perspective. How do I approach this? And to my surprise, I got this answer back. As funny as this meditation program may sound, it's been quite trippy. And so I put this problem out, and all of a sudden I just hear this, like this voice, this disembodied voice. It wasn't me. And it said, you've spent your time on this planet embracing death. Now it's time to start to embrace life. And I thought about that and I was like, what? I have been embracing life. I've been embracing life by embracing death. But then I was like, well, wait a minute. Have I actually been embracing life? I don't know. I've been embracing death for sure. And I think a byproduct of embracing death is just living life as though you are ready to die. But I think there's a difference between that and really embracing what life has to offer. And so I think the lesson that I'm hoping to kind of work through over the next, I don't know, 40 years, how long do we have? Who knows? Is that instead of just leaning into the idea that my time is going to come and I'm going to die, and allowing that, the embracement of that, to just carry me on its wings through life and allow whatever comes my way to come my way. I think now more than ever, I need to hold on to that loosely, but also start to focus on how I can actively participate in guiding my life. Instead of just spontaneously going on these whims, these decisions, based on the fact, I don't have much time left, I might as well just go down this road and see what that feels like. What's that flavor? Instead, take a second and go, okay, I have far more time than I thought I was going to have. Well, how do I want to shape that specifically? Because I think the way I've been approaching life up to this point has more so been, I don't have much time left. I'm open wide. I have no decisions. I have no choices. I'm not going to think about where I'm going. I'm just going to be affected by life. I'm riding the bus, right? But now it's time for me to start driving the bus. And I got to start to learn how to drive, I guess.
Well, that is so beautifully said. And I mean, it's been such a privilege being able to chat with you these last two episodes, and so much to take out of it in the vein of Preconceived, about what we expect to get out of life and what we do get out of life. Yours is an extreme example that can still resonate and relate to everybody listening to this, about things that they did not expect to happen, about maybe taking the path unchosen, being put in a situation you didn't expect. And your wisdom is evident, and your ability to articulate your experience and the lessons you've learned is remarkable. And I'm so grateful that you've joined me on this podcast.
Thanks, man. Thank you so much, Dale. Honestly, I and like this conversation, like, again, this is so fresh for me. So like, to be able to have a platform to be able to work through these thoughts that isn't just on, you know, on the couch with my therapist, it's great. This is a part of the things we were talking about in that first episode, which is like just having the ability to talk about this kind of shit without clamming up and without holding judgment and just being open. And so thank you for giving me a space to try and work this stuff out, because it's not just me. Like, we're all trying to fucking figure this out. Life is weird, and I don't think anybody's got it figured out. So the more we can have conversations like this, the more we can all kind of have a grasp on what the hell this whole thing is all about.
Well, Jeremy, the pleasure really is all mine. Thank you so much for spending this time. You can check out Sick Boy Podcast. You should check out Sick Boy Podcast. It's excellent and gives you a really interesting perspective on healthcare and what it's like to be quote unquote sick. So Jeremy, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, dude.
And thank you, everybody, for listening to another episode of Preconceived. Have a great day.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.